From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In last night's debate, each of the presidential candidates was asked to give his definition of family. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with family historian Stephanie Kuntz, the author of The Way We Never Were, a new book about the myths surrounding family life in America. The candidates were also asked about racial division in America. We'll talk with Ron Walters, who says the candidates have been avoiding African-American issues. Walters is the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. And book critic John Leonard reviews Doris Lessing's new book, African Laughter, about her recent trips back to Africa, where she was raised. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Egyptian authorities report at least 200 people were killed in a major earthquake in that country today. Another 1,200 people are hurt. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Authorities have declared a state of emergency in Cairo. Many of those killed and injured were caught in buildings that collapsed or were damaged. A number of primary schools are said to have collapsed while they were in session. The Interior Ministry says some casualties resulted from people being trampled in panic that followed the earthquake. Thousands of people ran into the streets to escape shaky buildings. Doctors at local hospitals appeared shaken and disoriented as hundreds of trauma victims were being wheeled and carried in. Authorities said they had difficulty getting complete details on the Tumblr because telephone lines were down. Initial readings put the earthquake, which lasted 20 seconds at 5.9 on the Richter scale. It was centered some 20 miles southwest of Cairo and is the strongest on record this close to the city. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
The Israeli army reported today that soldiers killed two Arabs who crept into the occupied West Bank last night. The Arabs were armed with knives. John Devitt reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli authorities say the two Arabs had penetrated the closely guarded border 7 kilometers north of Jericho, but had alerted an Israeli patrol. The soldiers pursued the infiltrators and opened fire, killing them both 200 meters into the Israeli-occupied territory. According to the Israelis, the two were carrying knives and clubs. They weren't wearing uniform of any description or carrying ID. The commander of Israel's central region, Major General Danny Yatom, said it appeared the two had intended to attack Israelis. This is the third attempt to cross the border from Jordan this year. In August, Israeli soldiers shot dead 3 armed men, and 2 months earlier, 2 gunmen swam across the Gulf of Aqaba and shot an Israeli security guard before one was killed and the other captured. For National Public Radio, I'm John Devitt in Jerusalem.
Georgian Republic leader Eduard Shevardnadze overwhelmingly won election as Georgia's parliament chairman, the top government post in the former Soviet Republic. Although he ran unopposed, Shevardnadze would have lost if he'd received less than a third of the votes. The balloting was seen as a referendum on the legitimacy of Shevardnadze's rule as leader of the governing state council. He returned to power in his native land in March after the ouster of President Zviad Gamzat Kurdia in a brief civil war. U.S. air ground crews are back at work after a week-long strike. Members of the Machinists Union began returning to work last night after ratifying a new contract on Saturday. The airline now plans a full schedule of flights. The new contract features a number of labor concessions, including a 1-year pay cut of 3.5%. It also prevents the company from hiring non-union workers for some jobs. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up more than 32 points at 3,168.71. This is NPR. The three presidential candidates battling for the White House met in debate last night. They covered topics from AIDS to foreign policy. Democratic presidential hopeful Bill Clinton said he represents hope for real change. President Bush dismissed what he called change for change's sake. Texas billionaire Ross Perot presented himself as a strong businessman who was best suited to end the gridlock in Washington. President Bush and Governor Clinton clashed early over judgment and character issues, but the tenor of the event quieted after that. Two Americans received this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine. They were honored for research on basic cell functions. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
The prize goes to University of Washington biochemists Edmund Fisher and Edwin Krebs for work they did in the 1950s. They studied how cells control their energy diet in a process called reversible protein phosphorylation. In the 40 years since their crucial discoveries, Other scientists have shown that this process controls how cells divide and communicate with each other. Defects in this system can lead to diseases like diabetes and cancer, and researchers expect that Fisher and Krebs's work will lead to a new generation of drugs to fight these diseases. When he learned this morning he had won the Nobel Prize, Fisher said he was totally overwhelmed. He and Krebs, both in their 70s, will share the prize, which is worth $1.2 million. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
Officials in East Point, Georgia, report that a small plane crashed and burned on the town's main street today. It was trying to land at Hartsfield-Atlanta International Airport. Two people on board the plane were killed. Three others were critically injured. There are no reports of any injuries on the ground. London police report a bomb shattered a pub during lunch hour today in the popular Covent Garden section of town. Five people were hurt, one seriously. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During last night's presidential debate, Ann Compton asked each of the candidates for their definition of family. My guest, Stephanie Kuhns, is a historian of the American family, and she says many of our images of traditional family life are myths. Families have always been in flux and often in crisis and have never lived up to nostalgic notions about the way things used to be. Kuhns is the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trip. She teaches at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I asked her if she thinks it makes sense to include family values on the political agenda.
Family values don't even make sense to me as something that I can define. You know, the whole phrase was not even used first until 1976. It's a phrase that would leave traditional Republicans with a small r kind of scratching their head and wondering what's going on. I've looked around for definitions since I can't find them in the past. And one of the spokesmen of for family values said, for example, in the Washington Post, that family values is how we feel about parenting, marriage, and sexuality. And what strikes me as a historian is what a tremendously truncated definition of morality that is. By that definition, organized crime families are among our leading moral exemplars.
What do you mean?
Well, they are definitely believe in chastity before marriage, long-lasting marriages, intergenerational bonds, a lot of loyalty. I'm disturbed by the way family values in this campaign has become a substitute for discussing more substantive issues of justice and distribution and even, yes, morality. But morality is not just something that goes on in our sex lives. It has to do with the way the society relates with each other.
What do you think family values have become such a subject of discussion now?
There are two reasons I think that family values are hot. First of all, I think for some time we've seen building a new social Darwinism of the 1990s, which blames poverty and unemployment and urban decay on the so-called collapse of the family. I think that's false. I think we should get into that if we have time to do so. The second reason that it's hot is because politicians are looking, of course, for ways to tap into people's immediate emotions on things by looking at polls. And I think the Republican strategists made a big mistake. They saw the polls that show that 75% of Americans think there is a moral issue in America, are concerned about the family, and they erroneously concluded that those same people would then buy into a simplistic campaign based on moralism. As it turns out, they were wrong. Most Americans can simultaneously believe that there are moral issues and things to worry about in the family and still be opposed to attempts to impose one rigid family norm on Americans or to force women back into their so-called traditional roles.
In your book, you make the point that historically Americans have become most preoccupied with personal morality and family organization when they've felt overwhelmed by harder issues of public morality and social organization. What's an example of that?
Well, the American tradition of individualism makes it very difficult for us to discuss ideas and structural changes that are not caused by individual character flaws. And so there's continually a temptation in America when we have a growing gap between rich and poor or a discontinuity between our economic and political ideology and the reality, to look for things in people's individual lives that can explain that. And that's why whenever there's been a major change in the way we reproduce ourselves socially and economically, it's often been experienced as a personal change. Good example would be at the end of the 19th century, with a new mass consumer society, new immigrants, problems with slums as America became urban, new kinds of economic dislocations. Then, as now, there was a tremendous campaign to blame all these things on people's family failures. Just as then, as now, there was an attempt to say that if only women would take care of all of the obligations and dependencies of this changing society, we'd be okay. That was the period when they first criminalized abortion, which had previously been legal. And the same sort of rhetoric that we're getting now about women's selfish individualism prevailed then.
You make the point that the traditional American family, the way it's conceived of now, never exactly existed, that concept of the traditional family really is a mix of different types of families that come from different historical periods. For instance, you say that the image of the mother as being totally available to her children comes from one historical period of the family, and the image of, like, the parents being this truly always in love, sexually involved couple comes from another image of the family. Let me ask you to put the pieces of this together.
Well, we have kind of mushed together all of these ideas that a man's home was his castle, there was once a time when children were protected from sex, that women used to be available to their kids. And as you say, these are all different ideals, none of which existed in its stereotypical form, and none of which coexisted at the same time. In colonial days, certainly a man's home was supposed to be his castle, but in fact, neighbors and church officials intervened all the time. There was male dominance, yes, as so many fundamentalists want us to go back to, but they would be horrified by the sexual frankness of an age. This was an age when first grade readers used the word fornication as a good example of a four-syllable word. Similarly, then, some people think, well, let's go to the little women kind of division of labor between men and women, when women were totally available to their children. The first thing you have to understand about that is that women could give up their older tasks of childcare and textile making in the middle class only because a new immigrant working class took that over, including children, took over those tasks. So childhood was lengthened in the middle class only by foreshortening it in the working class. But even in the middle class family, relations were very different than many moral conservatives would like to imagine, because that tremendous division of labor between men and women alienated women from men. They thought of men as much coarser. They found their most intimate and even sensual bonds with other women.
You say that the idea of the eroticized married couple comes from the 1920s.
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, in the early 1900s, a new ideal arose that put the family as the center of self-fulfillment. Prior to then, not only had there been larger political responsibilities associated with notions of morality and virtue, but the family itself was rather sternly defined as the place where character was built. It was not considered to be the place where you got all your emotional, sensual, and personal needs met. But in the 1920s, there was this new idea that the family would be the center of every emotional satisfaction and every erotic satisfaction that you have. It was a period where you had your first sexual revolution, every bit as shocking to contemporaries as that of the 1960s, but it was all channeled into the idea of this newly eroticized heterosexual relationship ending up in marriage. The result, of course, was what you might expect. The more emphasis you put on finding all of your personal, sensual, economic, every satisfaction in the couple relationship, the more intolerable a couple relationship that didn't work seemed to be. So it was also the 1920s that had this very sharp rise in divorce rates, and when the first demands for the legitimation of gay and lesbian unions were raised.
I think a lot of people who think back to a traditional family use the 1950s family as the model. I think in some ways that's the model that people are nostalgic for. But you think that the 1950s family really broke from the past, as opposed to the 1950s family being the most traditional of families.
The 1950s was neither traditional nor is it a model, if I may say so. First of all, it was a historical aberration. For the first time in 100 years, the age of marriage fell, the fertility rate rose, the divorce rate fell. We've had the highest divorce rate since 1889, not since 1969. And in this pro-family period that people think of as tradition, it was really the first time anyone had ever fantasized that families would be the absolute center of people's lives. So A, it was not traditional. B, it was not ideal. First of all, the ideal did not correspond to the reality of many people's lives. A third of American children were poor throughout the decade. 50% of black married couple families were poor. Even in the families that did live in the kind of suburban houses that were publicized in the sitcoms, in fact, that the sitcoms were designed to sell, not everything was as happy as people like to pretend. We're only now learning about the incest, the alcoholism, the abuse. Wife battering wasn't a crime. Even in less extreme cases, there was widespread marital dissatisfaction. Women were feeling so dissatisfied with their roles long before the feminist movement that the major word that news journalists were using about women by the end of the 1950s was trapped.
A lot of people look back to the sitcoms of the 50s and say, well, maybe it was a little exaggerated, but that's the way the family should be, you know, the nice nuclear family unit. You look back on the television of that period and say, well, this is when consumerism really started, and your critique of television then has more to do with appliances than it does with the perfect family unit.
Well, advertisers in magazines and TV shows often call their shows themselves or the editorial content of their magazines the wrapper for their real product, which is the products that are being sold in the advertisements. And I think that the 1950s family of the sitcoms was the wrapper for the hot point appliances and the GE electricity that was being sold by these shows. And that ironically, the 1950s family was the first time that we got an equation of happiness with consumerism.
The 1950s is also the first time that there's a teen market. And, you know, part of that teen market is the emergence of rock and roll.
Yes.
And of a whole rock and roll culture. So where does that fit into your analysis of the changes within the family in the 1950s?
Well, I'm not one of these people who thinks that all of the modern youth culture, individualism, and sexual revolution is a bad thing. But I think that the important point to make is that any excesses that it has have their roots in a consumer society that began in the 1950s. The 1960s was in many ways a reaction to that consumer society, an attempt to say that there's a lot of hypocrisy behind these families and there's too much materialism. The consumerism, the me-first gratification that so many conservatives like to be to blame on the 1960s, I think can be shown to have originated in the 1950s and to be very closely attached to the family value that they mistakenly hold up as the ideal tradition.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephanie Kuntz. She's the author of the new book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stephanie Kuntz is my guest, author of the new book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. When you look back through American history, is there a time that you would single out to describe as time that when family life was at its strongest?
I'm not sure how to ever answer a question like that, because it depends how you define family. It depends how you define strong. There are some people who think that the colonial family was at its strongest because male dominance was unchallenged. And after all, in those days, a man had the right to beat his wife so long as the stick was no bigger than his thumb. That's where our expression rule of thumb comes from. There are others who look back and say, well, okay, that was a little rough, perhaps, so let's take the strength of the mid-19th century family model. But I think that that a lot of this idealization of family life that you find in the Victorian family is part of the problem that we're finding today, not part of the solution.
How is it part of the problem?
Well, it developed as older traditions of political responsibility and nurturing began to break down, and the new liberal democracy of capitalism said, considerations of altruism, interpersonal relations, pity, community custom, all of these are inappropriate in the market, in the law, and in political transactions. On the other hand, you know, we're human beings. We have to have these considerations. So what do we do with them? Well, emerging capitalist democratic theory said, let's put them all on the family. And women, in turn, were expected to bear the responsibility for all of them. So there was a polarization of previously diffused emotions and shared traits. All of the emotions that were no longer appropriate in public life were displaced onto the family. And I think that this is a problem rather than the solution, because it so greatly and tragically restricts our definition of cooperation, of morality, of commitment, and caring. Even when Murphy Brown answered Quayle on the, you know, which you would think would be the left wing, right, the cultural elite answer to Dan Quayle's comments about single mothers, what did she say? She said, a family is the place where commitment, caring, and love takes place. Well, yes, in some ways, but in other ways, what a tremendously truncated definition of obligation, commitment, and caring, if the only way we can conceptualize it is in family terms.
I wonder what your perceptions are of the family today. We're in a time where marriage isn't essential. You can be unmarried and not be a social pariah. You can be married and be childless. A lot of people are divorced. A lot of single parents, more early teen pregnancy than perhaps ever before. You'd know more about the statistics. And you look around, and the conclusion a lot of people reach when they see that is the family has totally fallen apart.
People have this kind of doomsday scenario approach to the family that I think is very unrealistic. I think we have to recognize that there have been trade-offs, there have been gains and losses, there have been different trends coming from different parts of the culture and economy that have different effects. To illustrate that, some things have been a real increase in freedom. The fact that a woman can now, if she finds herself pregnant or she doesn't have a husband, she can consider responsibly whether she wants to have a child on her own or not, and then think through whether she can afford that, how she can find male role models. I think that's a step forward. I don't think we should go back to the old days when she couldn't do anything about it, or if she did get pregnant, there was that shotgun wedding. On the other hand, there are other trends that are less elements of choice and reasonable discussion and thought. Much of the teen birth rate that we see is not such a rational choice.
As you mentioned earlier, many people blame a lot of social problems we're having today on the decline of the family. What's your response to that?
I personally get rather outraged about that. I'm a family historian. I've studied families in a lot of times and places. I know that family arrangements and family histories have an impact on well-being, but I have never studied a time or a place where family structure was the major cause of poverty or wealth in a society. And yet today we have the new social Darwinism of the 1990s, which says we're not going to blame racism, we're not going to talk about changing jobs, structures, forget the fact of the deindustrialization of America. All of the problems we face are because of single mothers. Now, that is nonsense. It's hogwash. It doesn't hold up empirically. The vast majority of poverty in this country is caused by racial and job structures, not by family structures. You want to talk about the decay of our cities? President Bush blames the collapse of our cities on the collapse of the family. The reason Chicago almost drowned last spring was because of collapse of its tunnels, not its families. America now ranks 51st in the world in its investment in infrastructure. That, I think, those are the kind of issues that are ignored when people turn around and say, use this convenient idea of saying, if you people would just get married, then you'd be fine.
You're a family historian. You're also a single mother. Have you, as a single mother, ever been anxious about the impact it would have on your child for you to raise your child single?
Well, I don't consider myself a single mother. I have parents who are involved. Christopher's father, who is remarried, have both been involved. I have students who are involved. We have fictive kin. I have stepbrothers. Fictive kin, yes. I have people who are not really related to us, but who act as cousins, uncles, brothers. So I don't consider myself a single mother. And I think the single mom, two-parent mom debate obscures the fact that, sure, it's hard to raise a child by yourself, but it's also hard to raise a child just with two people. There's an old African saying that it takes an entire village to raise one child. And there's a lot of truth in that. We all need to think about children in a much wider sense than we have done in recent years in this society.
Your last sentence in your new book about the history of the family is this: we may discover that the best thing we will ever do for our own families, however we define them, is to get involved in community or political action to help others.
Well, I find that as a mother and as a historian and as a daughter, that some of the most healthy family lessons that people learn have to do with when they get beyond their own little nuclear unit and go out to interact with others. As a mother, I know that some of my best times with my son have come when I have involved him in my family research or in my family work and have gone out and worked with other families, whether it's going to a soup kitchen to help serve soup, whether it's going out to interview other families. I remember as a daughter that my favorite memories of family life were when we would have people over who were active in the civil rights movement or the union movement, and we would sing those songs together, and nobody was worried about spending quality time with the kids. At a certain point, we'd all be put together in the same bed, and no parent would come in to give us these extra special goodnight stories, but they were wonderful, warm times because our family was teaching us the most important lessons families have to teach, and that is to go beyond, to move beyond your own family and reach out with trusting, cooperative relations with others. The one constant there is in human history is that the families that have worked well have been the families that have taught that.
Well, Stephanie Coons, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Stephanie Coons is the author of The Way We Never Were. She teaches at Evergreen State College in Washington. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the presidential campaign and the African-American vote. We'll talk with Ron Walters, the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's advised the Congressional Black Caucus and was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. We'll also get his reactions to last night's presidential debate. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Doris Lessing's new memoir, African Laughter. It's about her recent trips back to Zimbabwe, where she grew up, but was prohibited from returning to for 25 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Egypt's state-run news agency now says that more than 2,000 people were injured in today's devastating earthquake. The Middle East news agency says some 200 people were killed in the tremor. In Cairo alone, the quake destroyed at least 20 buildings. The tremor was felt in Jerusalem, 250 miles away. Officials say the pyramids, the Sphinx, and other ancient monuments seem to escape damage. The U.S. Geological Survey said initial readings put the magnitude of the quake at 5.9 on the Richter scale. The epicenter was some 20 miles southwest of Cairo. President Bush spoke at a rally in Springfield, Pennsylvania today and reflected on his performance at last night's debate. He repeated his apology for past mistakes and warned voters not to risk the country's future by choosing his opponent. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush assessed his performance last night, saying, "I don't pretend to be an Oxford debater, but I think I did okay. 3 weeks from whenever it is," he said, "you'll have a chance to decide." He then proceeded to go after his opponent as pessimistic and untrustworthy. Mr. Bush appeared in Pennsylvania just hours after Governor Clinton arrived in the state. Noticeably missing from the podium today was Republican Senator Arlen Specter, an incumbent who's locked in his own battle for re-election. The Bush campaign continued to stress today that the debate had somehow provided an opening for the president, and campaign aides insist there will be even greater interest in the next two debates. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Springfield.
With the first presidential debate concluded, attention turns to tomorrow night's meeting of the vice presidential candidates, Vice President Dan Quayle, Democratic candidate Al Gore, and independent candidate Admiral James Stockdale will square off tomorrow night at Georgia Tech's campus in Atlanta. A German communications satellite was deployed over the former Eastern European bloc today. The satellite was carried aloft by a rocket launched at Cape Canaveral. From member station WMFE, Dave Pignanelli reports.
The Delta rocket left the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station at 5:47 Eastern Time, sending a bright streak of light across the Florida sky. The 3,000-pound Copernicus satellite completes a series of three in network communications. Copernicus will provide service over what used to be East Germany and the Soviet Union, but will not move into its final position over that region for another couple of months. The network is scheduled to go online next year. Although this was the third in a series of satellites, the previous two were sent into orbit by French-made Ariane boosters. This final installment in the network rode atop a Delta rocket manufactured by defense contractor McDonnell Douglas. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 37.83 points to end the day at 3,174.41. Advances led declines by a margin of about 2 to 1 in light trading of some 127 million shares. This is NPR. Officials at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles report a pig's liver was transplanted into a comatose woman in an effort to save her life. Authorities say the woman underwent 8 hours of surgery beginning early Sunday. She was in very critical condition to begin with, but is reported as increasingly stable today. The hospital says the surgery was performed only after a national search for a human liver failed. The pig's liver will be used temporarily until a human liver can be found. The identities of the patient and the 6 surgeons who participated in the operation were withheld. In Angola, high-ranking opposition leaders are demanding that results from the country's multi-party elections be nullified. Leaders of the UNITA party repeated charges of widespread election fraud and called for new elections within 3 months under United Nations supervision. NPR's Sunik Khalid reports.
High-ranking UNITA official Celo Pinto Pena told Portuguese radio this morning that widespread fraud in Angola's democratic elections had been proven. But Onofre dos Santos, director of Angola's National Election Council, denied the claims. Dos Santos also said the final election results, which have been delayed to probe alleged irregularities, would be announced later this week. UNITA, the former U.S.-backed rebel group, has threatened renewed civil war if the election results are released. UNITA leader Jonas Savimbi trails incumbent José Eduardo dos Santos in Angola's presidential race. But sources said that support for dos Santos has now dipped below 50%, which would prompt a runoff election with Savimbi. Meanwhile, political tensions remain high in Angola's capital, a day after five people were killed in a downtown Luanda shootout between former rebel troops and anti-riot government police. I'm Suni Khalid in Luanda, Angola.
Two Americans received the Nobel Prize for Medicine today. The researchers are credited with discoveries illuminating human biology. Edmund Fisher and Edwin Krebs will share the honor. Their discoveries were made during the 1950s. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In last night's presidential debate, only one question was asked about racial divisions in our country. My guest Ron Walter says the debate failed to adequately address African Americans, and so has the entire campaign. Walters is the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's been a staff member and advisor to several members of the Congressional Black Caucus and was deputy campaign manager for issues in Jesse Jackson's 1984 presidential campaign. Walters is the chairperson of Howard University's Political Science Department. The issue of race was raised last night by John Mashek. His question was this: racial division continues to tear apart our great cities, the latest example being Los Angeles. Why is this still happening in America, and what would you do to end it? I asked Walters what he thought of the question.
I didn't think that the quality of the question really was what the problem deserves. This election is taking place against the backdrop of Los Angeles and several other cities just having exploded. And a piece of legislation now is actually dying in the United States Congress. And so I think that this really was an opportunity for all three of them to say something in relatively specific terms about what it is they would do about that problem. And what we heard really were generalities about race.
Let me ask you about each of the candidates' responses to the question. President Bush said in response that he had passed two forward-looking civil rights bills. Would you care to comment on the president's civil rights record?
Well, I think the president was a little disingenuous about his record because finally when he signed the 1991 Civil Rights Act after having previously vetoed it, I think he did so out of tremendous pressures. One of those, of course, was the pressure at the time of David Duke, who was running very well in Louisiana, who was claiming that he was running on a Republican record, and therefore Bush wanted to distance himself from David Duke as a racist. And the other one, of course, was Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas. This was being postured as a piece of civil rights legislation that would be particularly effective for women's rights, and therefore the president felt the pressure of the women's movement as a result of the Anita Hill affair and felt that he had to sign it if he wanted to get their votes upon re-election. So in both cases, I think he really was pressured into signing something that he thought all along and said was really a quota bill. So I really don't think the president has a civil rights record to run on.
In one of his answers during last night's debate, the president said that he thought the decline in urban America stems from the decline in the American family.
I think the president is right about that. What he didn't go on to say were the reasons for the decline in the family. And I think that what has happened is that the Republican, especially the far right-wing ideologues, have suggested that the reason for the decline in the family had to do with individual circumstances and personal behavior, rather than the massive withdrawal of resources from the inner-city urban areas, which has taken place over the course of the last dozen years or so.
Let's get to Bill Clinton's response to the question about race and cities. And the governor said that he's taken his message to African Americans. He said he's devoted a major portion of his campaign saying to African Americans, Asians, Latinos, and whites, if the American people can't be brought together, we can't turn this country around. If we do come together, nothing can stop us. What did you think of that response?
I think his response was anemic. I think he's got the principle right, which is bringing people together. But the question becomes, how do you bring them together? Do you change, help to change their socioeconomic circumstances so that they're able genuinely to meet together across the table of common circumstances? So how do you do that? And what steps, concrete steps, do you take in order to effectuate bringing people together than simply rhetorically? And it's in that vein that I thought that his answer was rather weak.
Ross Perot said, we have to love one another because united teams win, divided teams lose.
I think he's certainly correct. But here again, I think he gave a substantially rhetorical answer. And Ross Perot said he felt so strongly about it that even in a subsequent answer, he had to come back and deal with the racial question. And in that particular instance, he said, if you hate, then I don't want your vote. And I think that was taken very well. But even Ross Perot didn't really spell out to the American people how race is articulated in a meaningful way in 1992. It is not just a question of brotherhood and loving one another and bringing people together. It is the question of providing the substantial resources by which all people can live together in dignity as American citizens.
We spoke during the primary campaign, and I asked you then how important you thought the African-American vote was seen as being in the Democratic primary. Let me ask you the same question now in the presidential campaign. How important do you think each of the candidates sees the African-American vote as being to them for a win? Now, and this isn't to imply that I think that all African-Americans vote the same way, but still groups of Americans are seen as voting blocks.
Well, the political history of the black community is that there has been a dominant vote for one party or the other. And so it is a proper question to ask how important is the black vote in 1992 as perceived by the candidates. I think none of the candidates, at least in the way in which I've detected it, considered the black vote to be critical to their electoral fortunes. In the past, of course, the black vote has been the balance of power in very close races as far back as 1976 when Jimmy Carter ran. But I think that this time around, the Bill Clinton looks at the black vote to some extent as a liability. There have been a number of analyses that have said that the black vote, of course, was the reason why substantial numbers of whites, and particularly Reagan Democrats, were running away from the Democratic Party. So I think he has postured his campaign, both in the primary and in the general electoral season, toward substantial white blocks of voters in the suburbs, Reagan Democrats in the cities, close-in suburbs, and other places, competing with George Bush on his own home turf.
What's Jesse Jackson been up to? You used to work in his campaign, so I figure you must know.
Well, Jesse Jackson has been trying to be a good soldier. He is now leading a voter registration drive. In fact, it just ended. And I might say that his voter registration efforts began at his National Rainbow Coalition Conference. You remember the one in which Bill Clinton came and talked about Sister Soldier?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that meeting, he had formulated a nonpartisan, independent voter registration campaign. And even after the conference, even after the remarks by Clinton, proceeded to go out and register voters. Subsequently, he was tapped by Ron Brown to do voter registration and a $1 million campaign, which was really woefully short. And then I think he has begun to do some very important registering of voters in a number of cities in the Midwest, the South, and in the East.
You say that Jackson is trying to be a good soldier. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I have not never been certain that Reverend Jackson was enthusiastic about this ticket. The ticket, I think, did as much as it could to distance itself from Reverend Jackson. And still, he is helping all that he can. So I think that in that sense, it takes a lot to put your own feelings aside and to go for the cause of the Democratic Party, the cause of black constituents who might benefit from a better administration than George Bush's. So to this extent, I think even though he isn't enthusiastic, I think he's doing what he conceives to be in the interest of others rather than just himself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ronald Walters, and he's the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's the chairman of the Political Science Department at Howard and was a consultant to Jesse Jackson's campaign. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Walters, author of the book Black Presidential Politics in America. What are some of the issues pertaining to race and pertaining to cities that you think should be addressed in this campaign that aren't getting addressed or aren't getting sufficiently dealt with?
Well, I think as the candidates talk about public policy, especially about national economic development or about job training or about education, simply because these things are mentioned, the public might get the impression that one is automatically talking about and including the inner city areas. That's not necessarily true. It's possible to talk about these things and expend the resources in a way which really doesn't affect inner city areas, as we saw in the 1980s. A tremendous period of economic growth in the 1980s, and yet much of that growth occurred right around the inner city areas that needed it most. So what I think is necessary is when one talks, for example, about economic growth, to target the inner city areas, to talk about the sorts of programs that would truly initiate economic growth in those areas, self-sustaining growth so that people could have jobs and businesses and hire people in those communities and revitalize those communities. If one talks about education, again, I think it's necessary to talk about public education, where most inner-city children are, and how one improves the quality of that education. The same with issues like job training. We have a job training program, JIPTA. We've had it for some time, Job Training and Partnership Act. It has not been effective at dealing with job training for the hardcore unemployed. And so the question, again, is targeting. So that you have an effective program which deals with the problems of that particular constituency. So I would say generally that unless one talks in relatively specific terms about these kind of issues and does so with sensitive targeting, I don't think you're going to have not only the appeal to the black constituency, but valid policies actually to deal with the problem once you have a new administration.
If race hasn't been a real talking point in this campaign, are you pleased at least that there hasn't been like a Willie Horton campaign in which there was a code way of talking about race? Or perhaps there has been one?
Well, I haven't seen yet the kind of power that the last Willie Horton symbol raised in the American electorate. I think that we have had a lot of talk about this was Willie Horton or that Willie Horton. We now have a concept which has passed into the lexicon of American politics, and it's used for a variety of things. But certainly I think it's possible to isolate some of these things. For example, take the issue of welfare reform.
Mm-hmm.
I think when one looks at the way in which the campaigns have treated this issue of welfare reform, one can find that both Democrats and Republicans have used this issue as sort of a racially coded issue. Same thing with the issue of crime. So that there are a number of racially coded issues now which perform that function of sending signals to certain constituencies that the candidate will deal with the ethnic populations associated with those issues in a particular way. The welfare reform issue, both Reagan and Bush have associated themselves with a relatively punitive way of treating welfare recipients with respect to the issue of crime. Clinton says we need 100,000 more police on the street to deal with the issue of crime. That's a very questionable assumption. So I think that when you see these concepts put out, I think it's very easy to see that, yes, they are using Willie Hortonism, but it is not recognized as using it in a way which evokes the very powerful symbolism of the past.
How would you grade President Bush's record in his 4 years as president dealing with African-American issues?
Well, I think that George Bush's record has been disastrous. I think, as is now the general wisdom, that he certainly not cared about domestic policy overall. And so to that extent, we've had modest increases in things like funds to fight the drug problem. He has tried to innovate in the area of education by his Education 2000 program. I think that the general approach to urban problems has been the same as his education concept, and that is a question of competition will solve everything. The market factor, even with respect to social policy, will be effective. I think I see that also in his approach to welfare reform. I don't believe there's one scintilla of evidence that the market approach to all of these social problems will be effective for most of the people who are affected by disadvantage. And yet I think somehow we accept the notion that enterprise zones are going to be a savior, that somehow choice schools will be a savior. And most of these competitive type approaches to solving these very vexing problems where people wouldn't really be in the situation they're in if they could compete, whether or not that's going to be effective. So George Bush has not really had a program dealing with the inner city areas. And I think that that's one of the reasons why he is especially vulnerable at this time.
So just to summarize the picture you've painted, you say that President Bush's policies racially have been disastrous, that Governor Clinton isn't doing enough to really address African-American issues, and that you suspect it would be the same way if he got elected, and furthermore, that candidates are almost afraid to court the black vote for fear it might alienate white voters. So where does that leave us in your mind?
Well, I think that leaves us at a very dangerous place because I think we have seen the tendency for people in the urban areas, black, white, Hispanic, otherwise, to act out ultimately if their frustration level grows to an unbearable extent. I would hate to think that that's the way intelligent people handle problems in 1992. But it seems as though if this particular constituency is not politically salient, then certainly public policy is not going to flow. And that's the message that I think people are getting. And I think that what we have to do, unless there is a movement in another direction, to gird up for a period of rocky social relationships in this country for some time to come.
Ron Walters is the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He chairs the Political Science Department at Howard University. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, will you be reviewing last night's debate?
Hi, Terry. Just a bit. In the context of campaign news today, the day after the debate, plus we'll jump to tomorrow's vice presidential debate in Atlanta. Nina Totenberg reports on the campaigns thus far of Senator Al Gore and Vice President Dan Quayle. We have some thoughts on exploring Mars on this Columbus Day. One scientist knows what his job would be on Mars, and that's drilling straight down into the ice in search of organisms that could be revived. And I'll have a report about the Russian conquest of Alaska a couple of centuries ago and what happened there to the Russian-American fur trading empire.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Doris Lessing is best known for her novels about independent women, like The Golden Notebook and her Martha Quest novels, and for her science fiction novels. Her new book is a memoir called African Laughter. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Doris Lessing, at age 73, returns to the Africa of her childhood, to a black Zimbabwe that used to be white-run southern Rhodesia, to the imaginary homeland where she invented Martha Quest, to the bush where 50 years ago an attractive but above all self-assured young woman wheeling a nice clean bicycle advocated varying degrees of social discontent with revolution as a cure for everything, and to the family farm where she left behind parents who were difficult and a brother who was impossible. It's not a sentimental journey. Lessing is about as sentimental as an electron microscope. But Africa is one of her contending selves. Inside our skins, she says, we are not made of a uniform and evenly distributed substance, like a cake mix or mashed potato. We contain, in fact, as many alter egos as Anna Wolf had color-coded notebooks. Finding so much confusion and pain, Lessing wonders in African Laughter why anybody's laughing. Actually, she's gone back four times since she first left in 1949. In 1956, almost by accident, she learned that she was a prohibited immigrant. For months afterward, she dreamt of herself, lurking illegally in the bush, invisible even to her black friends. In 1982, just 2 years after independence, she was back again, listening to the rancorous monologue of the remaining white settlers, meeting the corrupt new class of black civil servants, dodging the hated North Korean soldiers imported to police the war-torn nation, and taking notes in bars, at clubs, on verandas, and on the road. On this road, she also had a terrible auto accident. But she was back again in 1988 to look into the schools, talk to missionaries and consultants, examine fish fossils and Bushman paintings, hear about AIDS, and hitch herself to the young idealists of the book team, working with women in rural villages to get them to write their very own collective history of grievance. The following year took her to suburbs, supermarkets, commercial and communal farms, the angry poetry and woeful hospitals, and sad new townships. She went everywhere and talked to everyone. What Lessing found in the bush was silence. The animals and birds are going or gone. And drought. All of southern Africa is drying up. And AIDS. In Zimbabwe alone, by the year 2000, 1 million will perish from the disease out of a population of 9 million. But at least they feed themselves, with a healthy surplus to sell to South Africa or to donate to famine relief in the Horn. And they are on the move, like the book team's community organizing. And they even write novels we ought to be reading, which Lessing describes. And if they laugh enough, maybe the rains will come. African Laughter amazes. After more than 30 books, a volume of poems, and an opera, after everything she's done and said about racism, colonialism, imperialism, communism, and psychoanalysis, after cats, canopians, and terrorists, a clairvoyant priesthood, a Neanderthal child, and Afghanistan, Doris Lessing is as fiercely intelligent and as tirelessly observant as she was when she first left home for history and literature. And more, from Africa, as from her brave solitude of wisdom and witness, like one of her whirling dervish metaphors from Rumi's Persian poetry and from modern molecular physics, she flies up into our hearts.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Doris Lessing will join us later this week on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurock directs the show. We'd like to welcome the listeners of WABE in Atlanta, which just picked up Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Iraqgate. What did President Bush do to support Saddam Hussein before Iraq invaded Kuwait? And did the Bush administration try to cover that up? We'll talk with Douglas Franz of the Los Angeles Times, one of the first reporters to investigate the story. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.